decide, and then when they decide when conditions are right to fertilize those eggs, and then they hold them until they are like hiding.
So would it be like December?
December 1st, April 1st.
I could almost live with that.
Well, normally we're protected by the weather.
Right.
Why it hasn't been a real big issue, but I watched California all through this exact same thing. Where they,
really?
They have those guys out in Bigger Bay, especially where targeting was big when caught, and I mean, the charter boat got in now, not just six pack going out and get them. So they eventually shut their seats down.
Really?
And so when I talked to those guys, they said, yeah, we fish year round. They said, yeah, we only get five, we get 10.
Oh. Yeah. Richard, you can start whenever you're ready.
Oh. Okay. Well, I'm not telling you I have a chance of doing this, but I'd like to stay on that. Okay, I'll call the meeting to order. This is a workshop for the Port of Berkeley Charter Commission on Thursday, February 24, 2022. Roll call, Danielle, please.
Larry?
Here.
Ken?
Here.
Joe?
Here.
Richard?
Here.
Sharon is absent.
Are there any modifications, additions, or changes to the agenda?
No.
Okay. Anybody need to declare a potential conflict of interest?
Nope. No.
I have no public, there's no public here, no public comments in front of me. Is there anything online that you know of, Danielle?
No, but we do have our lawyer and James with Cal Or Insurance online.
All right, that brings us to information item A, the vessel Miss Stacy.
All right, the latest update with Miss Stacy, Rick and Julie, which are the son and daughter of DC Conkle, they have reinstated the port insurance coverage on the vessel Miss Stacy. They did that on January 24th, 2022, and they told us that they are interested in fishing with the vessel next crab season. They have scheduled a marine survey on the boat on the 25th of this month, which is tomorrow. And they'll provide us a report on that when that comes out, and hopefully a plan of restoring the boat in order to fish next season. Rick did say that he hauled out the boat a couple years ago in Eureka to do some maintenance on it. That's pretty much end of our update on Miss Stacy.
James Walker is on.
But he has ordered a survey.
Yeah, it's scheduled for tomorrow. Yeah.
Will you guys be in on that?
We're not planning on being there.
We will get the copy of the report, though.
Yeah.
And then once we get the copy of the report, find out what they plan on doing, we'll come back to the board, and then we'll decide, the board wants to decide to continue with their mortgage. That's the next step.
We haven't removed the lien, correct?
The liens are still there.
So we have to decide on that too?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Information item B, derelict dump or abandoned dump.
All right, so I provided some information where me and Travis looked at the boats that we have in here based on our criteria, I guess you can say, we had 20 to 25 vessels that we thought might be at risk or future problems. My cover sheet, I just put in our definitions for what our definitions for abandoned, and then the state of Oregon's definition for abandoned vessels, and then the state of Washington, just give you an idea what other agencies considered abandoned vessels are, or derelict vessels. I know this is our discussion to talk about our bonds. And we do have Jess Webster from Miller Nash. He's our maritime expert. And then James Walker is also online. So, and also James Tavin with Cal Or, our insurance carrier, is online. So we have our discussion about bonds.
Okay. So as I understand this, reading through it, the process you're proposing is that you, using these criteria, some objective criteria, will decide whether or not you think the boat is in peril of being abandoned. And at that point, you'll put them on a list.
Wait, it'd be like a watch list, I could, as you'd say, would be eyeballing, making sure that they abide by our insurance policies and paying on time and taking care of the boat. I think we'd probably be talking to them a little more than we normally do with other boats that are moving about and that we see leaving. That's accurate.
Well, the way that just I got out of reading this, maybe it was Washington's package, but somebody talked about saying, okay, we're gonna make a judgment based on some criteria that we're gonna start watching this boat and notifying people what we have concerns about it, which makes sense. I like that, as long as it's based on an objective kind of standard of some kind, where you can say, well, you meet this definition, so.
That's what Daniel.
Yeah. Well, you should just get like a red card and hold it up. They've all skipped that every time. I don't know why. But. All right, let's put information item B in suspension for a minute and approve the agenda. We'd like to make a motion.
Motion to approve the agenda as written for the February 24th workshop meeting today.
Okay.
Second.
All right, now we have a motion and second to approve the agenda as written. Danielle.
Larry?
Yes.
Ken?
Yes.
Joe?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes. Thank you. Back to abandoned boat.
Yes, I think, you know, given, you know, these, you know, plus anything else that might come up that might fears in the attention of the boat, you know, those pumps kicking on all the time, you know, there's other things that could come up, but we went through and made this kind of our list of, if we're not getting one or some of these things, we should definitely look and see why. Because most of our customers, you know, they don't fall under this, but there is some. So I think that's where we're going to base it off from, and then using our current rules, our current standards, I think we have enough to start getting some action out of them if we so see it fit.
What is the action going to be?
In the mortgage license agreement, is the next thing we're going to be looking at. One of the things we're going to be asking to put in there is that we can ask for a current condition survey at any time if we feel it necessary. That's, you know, kind of what we want to be able to do. If it's seaworthy, you know, come down and start your boat and show me it'll move. You know, if you haven't been to your boat in a year or 2 years, I don't think it's all that far-fetched to say, prove to me it's still in seaworthy condition. Looking inside, making sure there's no water, no oil, accumulate all those kind of things we can still do right now.
It could be just a phone call from Travis saying, what's going on with your boat too? This initial, what's going on? Because it's not moving, looking pretty bad. I mean, that could be the very first phone call. It's like, get a line of communication going on, see what's going on. Well, and then decide from there.
I think the Stacy is a pretty good example of what's probably most likely to occur. The owner dies or is incapacitated. Nobody else is picking it up, so the boat's just sitting there. And, yeah, initiating that discussion would be helpful if you know if there's somebody you can call.
Mm-hmm.
And I see on the mortgage agreement you have included another guarantor on there.
Right, that's for the corporation.
Right.
Corporation boats. And we've been doing this. I think last year that's kind of how we got a couple of our sailboats that we ended up demoing through Oregon State Marine Board. Is based on the owner's passed away or the daughter. It's took over the boat, going to take care of the boat. I mean, it's, and then another one where the guy sold a boat for a dollar to a homeless person. And then he couldn't provide us insurance or the mortgage, so he just left it.
Yeah, one wood sailboat down there that, to me, was an extreme risk, and it got sold. It's the same that's down there. And since then, the new owner, he showed it runs, it goes into gear, it moves back and forth, and it doesn't leak a drop of water. And so I went through the inside of it. I looked through the whole inside of it because it was one of the conditions I told him. I said, I don't know if I'm going to give you a mortgage agreement for this. And he's held up to every single thing he said he's going to do. And at this point, it's not nearly the risk I thought of. So, you know, being able to talk to the owners and, you know, go down there, start your boat, and drive it to the end of the port and back. That's a lot of what I'm looking for. And we don't really have much more beyond seaworthiness, you know, but all that kind of falls into it. You can't have leaking oil. You can't discharge oil out into the water. You know, a lot of the rules we have will cover it. It's just a matter of, you know, digging deeper into the problem boat and making it more of a priority to find out what is the plan. And that's conditional surveys, I think, will help us, especially with a lot of the boats that we have in question. You know, because we are going off from what Gary and I think, you know, and we don't know everything. So this current surveyor will be able to at least back up or say, you know, maybe it's in better shape than what we think.
Okay. I have some thoughts. You've got six items listed. I think there's a few more that could be added. One is any vessel that's over 30, 40, 50 years. There are certain vessels that, you know, fiberglass boats, these ones that were made in the 50s, 60s, the yachts, the fiberglass separating, they're becoming they're not seaworthy. And we have a couple of them in the port. You go around to all the different ports and you'll see these vessels that haven't been operated for quite some time. But commercial vessels that do not have current safety inspections, if a boat's inoperable power plant or a sailboat has no sails or it has no mast on the boat, you know, those are all good indicators. What I'm, you know, this definition of a derelict or an abandoned boat, there's no teeth in this stuff. We don't want these boats or the vessels. I don't want to seize them. Now, we are assuming responsibility, and we've got to pay to get rid of it. I would like to put some teeth into, you know, if we have at-risk vehicles and they are identified by criteria that is, you know, standard for all vessels in the port, and we determine that they're high risk, then I think we should be doing something. And again, that's why the attorneys are here, I would hope. A surety bond is one thing. You could put a second on real property. You could do a CD that the port is named. You know, they should be posting funds that are equal to what it's going to cost to dispose of that vessel. That's my opinion. And then, you know, we don't want, again, we don't want to burden the taxpayers with disposing of somebody's private property. And I think you just mentioned that I know it's been done in the past, and Washington has gotten put some teeth into there. You know, some guy has a, you know, Joe's boat's no longer functional. He sells it to some homeless person for a dollar, does the transfer. He is now legally no longer the owner of that vessel. But now we have somebody that, you know, has no ability to do anything. That's just my thoughts on it. And there's got to be some different, you know, whether it's increased insurance or some manner of, in their mortgage, that once that vessel is high risk, that we can attach some other financial responsibility to it if they want to continue to monitor.
Okay. Anything else? All right, we'll move to a similar item.
You want to hear from Jess or James on the
I'd like to hear from the attorneys if any of this is doable.
What I was thinking about was going to the mortgage license agreement.
James, mute yourself. Is that loud enough?
Is that the hear?
Okay.
Okay. So let's move to the mortgage license agreement provision.
Okay, I'll just pass this right off to James, Jess, that made these revisions, and let them explain what he added to strengthen our agreement.
Okay.
Jess, you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, very good. You know, as far as dealing with potential derelict vessels, the one thing is this is not directly talking about your mortgage license agreement, but the first place I think you should look is to your own insurance. And as I understand it, under your current insurance coverage, you have wreck removal liability coverage, or wreck removal expense coverage for vessels up to 30 feet. So in my mind, that would be one criteria beyond which you could start imposing additional burdens on your tenants in terms of security or required condition surveys or the like. I had also suggested that you check with your own insurance brokers to see if it would even be possible to get endorsements to your policy for specific vessels that are over 30 feet in length for an additional premium, which premium you could just pass on to the tenants owning larger vessels. In Washington State, they do impose liabilities on people or secondary liability on people that would transfer ownership of larger and older vessels. And under Washington state law, that's more than 25 feet in length and more than 40 years old. So you've got that. But as you said, the derelict vessel laws are cumbersome. And, you really don't want to take possession and title to a derelict as a step towards disposing it of your own expense if you can avoid it. And so beyond just the laws, you can have contractual agreements with your tenants that give you additional rights. The first change that I proposed on your mortgage license agreement, which was, I believe it's included in your information packet, is to always ensure that every time you take a tenant, that you impose personal liability on the principals of any corporate entity that might own a boat. It's essential that these people have their own skin in the game. And so that is an important first step and one change that I had proposed to the agreement. Another important change, a lot of these are small changes to include things like your ability to collect attorney's fees if you have to incur costs to deal with vessels and breaches of your mortgage agreement. But in section 9, as I think it was Travis, I wasn't able to see who was speaking, suggested that the port should have the discretion to require a condition survey at any time, confirming seaworthiness, and you can require that all recommendations in the survey be promptly performed by the tenant, or it would be a breach of their tenancy. I also proposed that in paragraph 11 that you have a holdover tenancy fee that would increase the mortgage fees paid by anybody who is a holdover, as, you know, just one more disincentive for people to leave their vessels and stop paying their mortgage. And then in a new paragraph 15 that I added is the basic requirements to add a personal guarantee that would be binding on the principal of any corporate owner. And that completes the changes I suggested in the mortgage license agreement. I think you should also consider revising your ordinance dealing with vessels to update it to, amongst other things, recognize that federal maritime law will probably control your rights in dealing with vessels as opposed to state statutes that deal with chattels, personal property items. If you have any questions regarding the proposed changes to the mortgage license agreement, please let me know and I'll try to field them for you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, sir. I have a question on the insurance. How do you, if the person cancels their insurance prior to abandoning the vessel in our port, what value is the insurance?
At that point, none. You have identified a problem that's inherent with this, especially as someone describes the scenario where the fisherman founder of the family dies, and then, you know, family members end up with this albatross on their hands. They don't want to deal with it. They don't fish it. The income stops. They start, you know, they just create a liability, and then they stop paying their insurance. You know, at a minimum, you'd want to have 30 days notice on any cancellation or modification so you have some time to react. But after that, you're going to have to rely on what you have from the owner, either in the way of their personal obligations or any additional security you might require that they post to deal with a particular, you know, removal of a vessel. As you suggested, possibly a bond or alternate security. Or, you know, as I said, falling back on your own insurance and finding out whether it's even possible to get endorsements to your policy for specific vessels larger than 30 feet. If you were able to get that type of endorsement, even if the owner stopped paying you the premium, you could cover the premium until you got rid of the boat.
Okay. Any further questions? Did you see our insurance carrier is on?
Yeah. Yeah, James, 7. There, James?
While we wait for James to rejoin, can I make one comment with respect to the idea of having a bond?
Certainly.
I've checked with sources I have that are in the bonding industry, and hey,
can you guys hear me yet?
We can hear you now, James.
Just hang on a second.
Hang on for 1 second.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, sorry, my phone wasn't muted, but it was muted on your side. I had to push star 6. So currently, as you know, vessels over 30 feet are not covered. The current carrier, SDAO, who is really the only one who wants to insure the port, won't do it. Now, we are looking at some other options. Gary is apprised of that. There's some applications that we could turn in to see if that's possible. I don't know. I would assume it is, but at what premium? I don't know. On the surety, I've been told by my surety carriers that they would never bond a boat like that, that they would never want to take that on. Now, maybe it is possible, but I'm being told that it's not. And it doesn't mean we couldn't continue to ask around, but I don't think it's very feasible to do for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think a surety company is going to do it. And two, you would run into a lot of people who probably would never qualify for a surety of, you know, a $250,000 boat and stuff like that. So that's just my take on it. I like the idea of trying to find monoline coverage or another carrier that would come in over the top of the current policy to cover vessels up to, I think it's 110 foot, I think is the largest one in there. I think that's our only option, but I really don't think that the surety is going to be feasible. And again, maybe I'm wrong on that, but when I was first approached by Gary, I went to three different surety companies, and they all told me that they would never even consider it. So that's just where I am on that part.
Okay, thank you.
I just wanted to comment.
Go ahead, Jeff. You were commenting about bonds.
Oh, yes. I was just going to, before James came on, I was going to tell you the same thing, that there's probably no surety that would write that type of a bond, and the people who needed a bond probably couldn't qualify for it.
Okay. Thank you. So, any questions, comments? So it looks to me like we're getting a little more focused now on how to talk about abandoned vessels and then how to protect ourselves with our contract to the best we can on abandoned vessels. Great. Just as a note, I don't know if you've been reading the paper, but Charleston is asking their boat owners for insurance.
We knew it was coming.
It ain't going well. From what I've read, the owners are pretty upset. So.
Yeah, they just paid $60,000 to have a boat lifted off the bottom of something there that didn't have insurance. Came out of the port's pocket.
Part of the discussion was the boat owners are saying, look, you're going to put us out of business. We can't do that. And then the port's going, well, we're the only port in the state that doesn't require it. So if all these other guys can do it, why couldn't you? So it's gotten to that sort of a discussion. But anyway. Okay. Moves us on to port rates from July 1, 2022 to June 30, 2023.
All right. This is a little long discussion here. So every time about this time of the year, we review our rates, and the port staff proposes increases, and typically increases. And typically we request a CPI increase to our rates. And last year's CPI was 4.5%. I put in here our resolution 444, where we could, at discretion of the port manager, raise our fees another 2% for dredging. I'm not requesting that another 2%. I'm just looking at 4.5%. There's some other rates in here that I'm requesting to go up higher than the CPI, which I noted in my packet. I also put in here a comparison to other ports. The recreational vessels, I put 30 foot and above. You can see our rates at recreational is $48.45 a foot. Charleston 63.72, Salmon Harbor's 56.17. Astoria is a little bit different with their rates. They have a flat rate for the per foot, and then they have another rate for the electrical. And when you add the two, that's what you get, $71 a foot. And then Newport's at 82, and then Crescent City's at 41. I included Crescent City since they're close to us and they're kind of a summer-sized port. Commercial vessels, we're at almost $40 a foot. Charleston stays the same at 63. Salmon Harbor goes up to 61. Astoria, it goes up a little higher with their electrical fees. And Newport goes down by $18 to $63 a foot. And Crescent City goes up to 63 a foot.
What are the rates on less than 30 feet?
A lot of them just vary. That's why I didn't put them in there.
Is it based on the size of the slip as opposed to the size of the boat?
It's
whatever is greater.
Typically, but normally going down 20th or below 30, they just get all wonky and it's hard to compare the rates. It's not really comparable. That's why I picked 30 foot and above. That's kind of like our bread and butter of our boats. The gear storage, so the ones that have gear storage, we're sitting at 6 cents a square foot, while Charleston's at 20 cents a square foot. Newport's at 32 cents a square foot. Boat trailer storage, we're sitting at 61, while Charleston's at 74, almost $75. Newport, they have a 10-day limit that you can have a boat and trailer on site, and it's $10 a day. I'm assuming they have that because they don't want boats sitting there for a long period of time looking shabby, looking like we have some of ours. The annual boats, I figured I'd compare our annual boat launch prices and some of the discounts that the ports provide. And then our fuel charge per gallon over the steel wall. Then I provided kind of a narrative about our maintenance costs. Try to search Google to find, you know, what we should be spending on our docks and our facilities. And the best I can come up with is, this is for a home maintenance fund, 1 to 4% of the value of your home. So I just correlated that to our port. So I put in some numbers just to give you an idea of what we got. We got roughly 84,000 square feet of floating dock that we maintain. And that asset value is about almost $15 million. The port has roughly 35,000 square feet of building space, commercial retail building. That's including our restrooms and everything that we have, the building that we got maintained. And the value of all of our buildings, including our restrooms, is $4,700,000. And then the port size itself, we got roughly 50 acres of land that we maintained, and then about 20 acres of water space. So taking those numbers and comparing it to last year's expenses, our RV park, we spent $51,000 on. I put a little star in there. Our expenses included supplies, whatever supplies we needed for the restrooms, or anything else to take care of the facility. So we've got 51,000 RV park. And you look across, our value is at 877,000. So if you look using the 1%, 1 to 4% rule, we did spend a little more than what I found on my search. Leases, the leases is basically all of our buildings. I included the restrooms and that column, and we spent almost $23,000 last year. And based on that rule of thumb, we spent less than what we should have been to take care of our buildings. The fuel dock, I put the fuel dock in there. We spent $18,000 last year, and we were spending enough the money on a fuel dock. The marina, that includes our land and our docks, $203,000. It's just barely enough to keep it going. I did note in here, in my opinion, that the 1 to 2% area is probably maintaining a good equipment or good facility. 3 to 4% would be like handling deferred stuff. So that 3 to 4% we should be spending probably almost three times what we're spending now on our docks. If that's what my figure's going to be. I guess I'll stop there. If you guys have any questions, what numbers I've put together.
So I'm curious, looking at the voyage rate between recreational vessels and commercial vessels, why a commercial vessel pays less per foot than a recreational vessel, when I suspect there's a lot more wear and tear on the dock caused by a commercial vessel just because of the size. What's the rationale for having them less than a recreational vessel?
Historically, it's always been this way at this port. The commercial fleet has always had a certain amount of discount applied to their mortgage rates. Why? I don't have a good answer for you why it is. Because in taking what you say, the most wear and tear, the most damage, the most commonly used things, dock pedestals are used, water lines are turned on more, gangways are traveled more, docks are traveled more, all more that comes from it. So it's a very strong point that there is more cost incurred from a commercial use versus a recreational use, and just due to their size.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just curious how this discussion evolved.
I think another thing, Richard, was at one time, there was so much product brought across these docks. I'm not saying it was, that the funding for the dredging came from the product that was brought across the docks. I think, I'm not going to say that was, but I would throw that out there too, that one time, you know, years ago. I don't know if it still is or what, but you're right. We get pretty cheap rates.
My opinion is it's based on economic, it's economics. They're trying to bring in more commercial fishermen, I believe, to give them a better rate, to help them through their seasons and that kind of thing. It seemed like, going back in the history of this port, when it first started out being a port, I didn't see a discount or didn't see a rate difference between recreational and commercial, and then it changed, and it's automatically, they look like they have a 25% discount. And I think it was based on economics or trying to increase the commercial fishermen, I think it's just that trying to advertise more commercial fishermen business here at the port.
Well, to me, that is a pretty slippery slope, because if you look at the crab season this year, hard to make much of an argument that they took any kind of an economic hit because of fisheries. And so, no question that, you know, we chased this thing around. I mean, salmon's a classic example. You either fish some years, 2 or 3 days, or 2 months, or you never know. And that's a pretty unpredictable process. But to me, that discrepancy is somewhat troubling, to be honest. I mean, it's part of the reason the recreational side of the equation doesn't ever get as much recognition, I think, as it should. It's much harder to figure out what the value of a recreational fishing day is, as opposed to when you pull in here and land, you know, 25,000 pounds of crab, you know exactly how much money you made right then and there. And then you can, any landing that's done here, it's measured, it's weighed, there's a landing ticket written for it, so you know what that's worth. The recreational side, you don't know. And it's much harder to figure because you know, if you want to start talking about non-residents coming in, bringing a trailer or staying in a motel and even all those things that go into it, it's difficult to tell. But when I read this, that one just kind of jumped across the paper at me. I thought, huh.
Well, there's only one other court that has the rates lower for the commercial fishermen, which is Newport. But their rate is still a third higher than what ours is. Other ports have basically the same rates. You know, there's no difference between recreational and commercial fishermen.
Just looking at those two numbers, it appears to me that if we went to like $44 a foot for both recreational and commercial, you're at least on par. And I don't know what that would do to the overall finances of the port. I don't, you know, obviously you're going to make more money off commercial boats because they're just a lot bigger. But
dollar-wise, we make about three times as much money on recreational boats than commercial boats here. Just the sheer numbers of we have less commercial boats than ever we do recreational boats. If I remember the numbers, right, it's around 400,000 for recreational and about 150 for commercial that we made last year.
I mean, regardless of the impact of either one, you know, majority of our time maintenance costs, just so it's said, does come from the commercial side, and we have a third less commercial boats than we do recreational boats. And that's, you know, they are out there working, so it does require more, but the costs far outweigh the recreational side.
Well, I mean, certainly I don't want to put a target on my back and call out the commercial fleet and say, I got to get you, but there's no question how important the commercial fishery is to this community. In terms of jobs, in terms of all the stuff that goes with that, no doubt about it. So, you know, I'm not trying to make their life difficult, but at the same time, if that particular fleet is requiring essentially most of the service, then I'm not sure I can, in my mind, I can really justify a differential between the two.
And you know, clearly, not only are we lower, but we are substantially lower than a lot of other places, you know, and including the recreational. I mean, this port has always had the better rate for moorage on the coast, and we're not a bad port. We're not a port that deserves to be at the bottom. We do have nice facilities. We do have nice docks. And, you know, in comparison what any other port is doing, I mean, we spend more than what we should for the docks than what we're making. I guess that's what I'm at. And, you know, and that's why with some of our docks that are left out there that are pushing 50 years old, we don't, there's zero money left to even think about replacing them, even to barely do the standard maintenance that it needs.
Well, my windshield survey looking around the port tells me that the commercial docks are not in great shape. They just aren't. I mean, they're beat up. There's significant stuff that needs to be done to them. I mean, just nothing but putting that board in front of the bow of the boat that just keeps into it. So, Bill, want to comment about this?
I agree with you. I don't want to scare anybody away by doing a big rate increase, but I agree with you.
I never said it wasn't cheap. It's cheap, so.
Well, I don't want to put you on the spot.
You're not, Richard.
But I mean, what would be the honest reaction of the fleet if we said we're going to charge you $4 more a foot?
Some would complain, some wouldn't. the guys that, you know, there's so many of them. I see right there, but they don't make a lot of money. That's the deal.
Yeah, I
tend
to temper this by thinking about guys who are fishing pink shrimp, fishing crab, and guys who are fishing salmon. I mean, if you're a salmon fisherman, you're just, if you make, it's a hobby. Let's be honest, it's not a way to make a living anymore. It's a hobby. So hits to them are significant. I don't know that hits to the guy that's out there trawling or fishing for shrimp is as big a deal. But, anyway, thanks for the discussion. I was just always curious about that. It does seem to me to be not proportionate.
Any recommendations on the commercial rate then? Do you want to see a proposal saying same as recreational rate? I mean, just trying to figure out what you want to see in the next meeting, because I'll be looking to get approval on these rates, because we need to figure out the new rates, because we're working on our next budget cycle. So that kind of, we need to look forward to what's going on.
I would propose that, and I would propose that the rates between commercial rates, recreational rates, be put into alternative A and alternative B. Alternative A be what you have right here, current rate. And alternative B be $44 a foot per bush. That would be a decrease in recreational and an increase in commercial.
Well, we'll see what that does to our numbers. Okay. Might be too big of a hit to do that.
Well, you can make an alternative C then and put the rate at $48 and 46 cents. For commercial and rate. So that, you know, we have a choice there.
I just have a comment that, you know, by taking and subtracting, I don't know, when I look at these numbers and I see across the board, you know, commercial, the closest one, we're $21 a foot cheaper. That everything that makes managing easier and, you know, when people come in and they have these conversations with us, is that we're aiming to stay somewhat consistent with the rest of the ports and what else is happening. You know, Newport, Charleston, us, we all have docks. We all have maintenance that has to go into it. And when I see that a third less than what the rest of these ports are, and I hear we need dock work, or they're not into the state that they need to be, it's clear, it's very clear to me that we're not even in the neighborhood of charging, you know, right on the moorage. And I know we have to be careful about just saying we're going to go from this to this. We don't want to do it. But every single year that I've been here, we look at these rates, and moorage is one of the least talked about and, you know, raised rate that we have. And one of the common things we always have are marina doesn't have enough money to cover the cost that it has, and the biggest complaints we get is the docks are shit, that, you know, that we need dredging, we need all this. Well, it all boils down to there's only so much money that we have. These other ports seem to have the money, and their money coming from it is from their mortgage rates. And this needs to be, I believe, a pretty big topic, and I know nobody wants to be the person to say these rates are going up. But when we have $14 million worth of docks and we're only making $500,000 a year to cover wages, everything that we have out there, and then trying to do our maintenance, it shows its face right there why we're behind.
Well, this isn't the last time we're going to talk about this, I don't think. I'm going to do this every year, and I'm concerned about what you've said. So if we take this and run from $39, $40 to $60, that's a pretty big hit. But if we can incrementally change it, and then without any question, if I was a commercial boat owner and you up my rates up, I'd be expecting something out of that. So I want something that I could see as a bit, happen. So also want to be careful about that, raising the rates and saying, well, geez, give me a new marina now. You just put me out of business. You're $60 a foot. So I mean, this thing is not just a simple equation. It's much bigger than that. And I get what you're meaning. I mean, I see it, but I would just say probably the other ports were never in as bad a financial situation as we were either to start with. So. Anyway, that's how reasonable it is to have some alternatives to come back, and we can think about them and talk about them.
And I just want to add one other thing. If we do look at increasing our maintenance on our docks, we can spend more money on materials, but then Travis only has so many guys who can do it. So if we buy more materials, that means you got to have more labor, and that increases our costs as well. So that it's kind of twofold. If you want to increase our maintenance, you need more help.
I think, at least in my mind, there are going to be two different things there. You're going to have to do maintenance anyway. But at some point, we're going to have to say, we're going to have to replace docks and get new ones in. So if we can get to a situation where we're even helping a little bit, keeping up with just the routine maintenance that we're doing. With a little more revenue, that's one thing. If we're going to go to the next step, then that's going to be a big test. If we're going somebody's going to have to grant us some money, and we're going to have to be able to match it to do a big job like that.
And with that being said, I just think it's important that we don't forget about this rate, because once we get new docks, the cost of those docks are going to far exceed what we have now. The maintenance of it is going to far exceed what we do now. It's going to be more pedestals, bigger piling, bigger docks, longer bars. So, and, the boats aren't getting any smaller. So we're going to, more than likely, when we start talking about new docks and how we're going to fit them in, we already have boats that are way oversized for the slips. And to make even bigger slips, that means we're going to lose boats. So making sure that when we get to that point and we're at new docks, that we're not talking about the same thing, that we haven't caught up to what they should be paying today, so it's not as much of a shock. So, I mean, I agree with it. Over time, we need to get this there, but it's something we can't really drag our feet on, because once we get new docks, it's going to be real hard to justify leasing them out or renting the spaces for far less than what it costs to maintain what we have with brand new docks and start this whole thing all over again.
Well, if we did even a modest increase and see what that actually results in the revenue and compare that against expenses. I mean, I suppose at some point we could get to the spot where we said, okay, we're going to start charging $65 a foot, and a substantial amount of the money that we raise there is going to go into funding new docks and just create almost like an earmark to go do that, so they can see what's kind of, where they're headed with that. But I don't know that we're there. Yeah, we've got a lot of other things to fix first, I think, so. Okay. All right.
So to maintain new docks isn't the expense, but installing them, because everything has to change to have a new dock there.
Okay.
Is that what you're saying? It's not the actual maintenance. So the brand new dock should have no maintenance.
Well,
but putting it in place, making it fit, the pilings and everything else, all.
Well, that would change everything. But even when you have brand new docks, there is still. So I just sent through our guys through 84,000 square feet of docks that has a crack down it every 8 feet. And they've been out there for 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
removing grass from it. So to stay on top so you don't have grass that grows that then starts rotting out your woods, you have to tighten all your bolts at least twice a year. You know,
even on a new dock.
Even on brand new docks. And the more you do that and keep things tight, keep your tolerances tight, keep your piling hoops, your softeners updated, the less it moves, the longer it's going to last. The longer you let things start wiggling and moving, the faster it's going to deteriorate. So, you know, it's really important that when you have new docks that you're down there making sure that your good stuff stays good, replacing them as they come, making sure your bars don't get bore down and your rub boards stay good. It's not as much because you're not replacing that material. It's just the maintaining of it. So that's kind of where I'm saying that it will go down some, but the cost is still going to be there. And the new engineering of what you're going to get is going to be big, much bigger than what we have out there now. The requirements are just going to be bigger. The access ways are going to be bigger. So, and the bigger you get, the more expensive they are. So, I don't know if I answered it.
There's a significant difference in quality. Just looking at the recreational box there. When those new ones showed up, I mean, that was a light year improvement over what we used to be there. So, you know, if we ever do that, there's going to be good stuff available, I assume, to do this thing that's much more durable. I mean, we're a long ways from 55-gallon barrels stuck under two boards like we used to have here when I first started showing up. So. Okay. Brings us to information item E, the boatyard warehouse condition.
All right, so the boatyard warehouse, our tenant notified the court that the back door was broken, and when we went out there, if you see the pictures in your packet, we noticed a lot more than just the broken door. Rotten boards, lots of rotten boards. So we asked Jack to give us his recommendation. He brought an expert out here. He hasn't given me his report yet, but in the meantime, my final picture here, we put in some temporary posts there just to keep it from collapsing, I guess. Travis said that it moved like 3 inches, stuck down 3 inches.
Dropped 3 inches.
That was before or after?
Oh, I put that in there, and the truss currently is 3 inches down. I just posted it right. I didn't try jacking it up. I just left it right where it was at, but it's down 3 inches. The truss is pulled down and gripped the top rafters. The top rafters are still up there holding the metal. That's why from the outside the metal still looks straight, but the rafter dropped and just pulled the nails out of the rafter on the truss.
They're in such shape.
Yeah. Well, and they're spanning a long way through.
That's why you get it for the price. So that you get it.
Someone's coming out to look at that.
They looked at it. We're waiting for his written report, his recommendation what to do. I really don't know what to do other than we could go in there and do some quick repairs, replacing those rotten boards. Travis thinks he can, his staff might be able to do it. But there's a lot more wrong with that building. Like I noted a few things that we know what's going on wrong with that building. But you know, I guess it all depends on how far we want to go and how much money we want to spend on that really old building. I just want to live along a few more years.
I don't. We can't afford to replace it, but at the same time, I don't think we want to spend an awful lot of money trying to maintain something that, you know, if it's failing that bad, we're going to have to think about the realities of tearing it down and replacing it with something. So,
and I hate to play the what-if game, but what if an engineer says it's not safe? I mean, he could say that on the report.
There's a... Boom. With the condition of what this back wall is and this, just so I wouldn't be surprised if that's what he said. I wouldn't be surprised if we're maybe even asking a tenant that they can no longer be in there.
Right.
I think this back wall is that bad. That the post that we put under it, I'm super glad we did what we did. I'm a little more confident in it just sitting there, but, you know, we don't know what he's going to say, but it is in that bad of shape. And then as you start looking around the rest of the building, the roof, you know, the supports that are underneath them, you know, they might be okay for right now, but we're not far from this. So I personally think
some of
worst case scenario.
Rotten, isn't it? What
was that?
Some of that main timber going across is rotten, isn't it?
All right.
Well, if you're talking here about electrical service, I mean, that's so far.
Well, yeah, all of the electrical comes out of what Kenny's running right now, and then, you know, everybody's at his mercy. And we have one tenant, you know, who's basically paying for that power, and the electrical hasn't changed since that building got put there.
Well, from the sounds of it, we're going to have to make sure that we can still occupy the building. And then, so what we have to do to make it at least the best we can, but it sounds like it just moves pretty high up on the priority list or something to fix.
You know, and the good thing, though, I mean, me and Gary were talking about it, but we do have four tenants right now that are in there and occupying the space, and that if and when the new building comes, I mean, I think it's fair to say that we could say somebody's moving in there at a rate that might maybe hopefully cover a cost, you know, to put up a new building. I think we do have the tenants that could go in there. Of course, it's just about the money out and paying payments.
I mean, realistically for us, it's either paying interest on a loan or having a match for a grant. That's going to come right off the top. And then if we can make enough money off the tenants to pay a loan off, then you're okay, assuming that all the stars stay lined up and everything works, and we don't have a collapse in fishery or whatever, whoever's in there, you know, all those kinds of things. But obviously, we've got to do something.
Yeah, I think we're at the point we're going to wait for that report. Bring it back to you guys, and we'll have a serious conversation about what we're going to go with it next. Because I agree with you, it's kind of hard to dump money into that building at the shape of that. It's really hard to see money go into it. But if that's what we have to do, of course, that's what we have to do.
Somewhere in there may be a happy medium that, you know, we would satisfy the engineer with, well, if you do this, you can get by with it. And if it's just not too much, we can do that until we can get the rest of the whatever we're going to get lined up and fix it.
Okay.
I'm fighting that bad.
Let's think about it.
You have it all covered up.
Let's think about the port. The hits just keep coming, don't they? Okay, information item F, budget committee application selection process.
All right, I figured we can just talk about this real quick. So we have three vacancies on our board, our budget committee, and we got four applications in so far. And the deadline is March 7th, 5 p.m. So I figured on March 8th, around 9 o'clock in the morning, I can provide these applications to the board. And then I kind of laid out my idea of selection, where you guys look at the application and rank them 1 through 5. And the highest total number would fill the first position, the second highest, the second position, the third highest, the third position. And then any tiebreakers is flip a coin. Sound safe? And then I gave you guys the what the application looks like. It does, they do give you information of why they want to be on the board, so they kind of give you an idea of what they're thinking. That selection process sound safe, because it's probably be our next meeting, record meeting, we'll have that. Well, before the next meeting, we'll have that.
if you guys want to interview anybody, then like, you gotta let me know to have that before the next meeting.
We use a very similar process to rank stuff for our meeting, and it works fine. It's a good way to do it.
Okay. Cool.
Okay. Information item G, fuel tank control box, protective structure.
All right, so I think in our last regular meeting, or one of our meetings, we talked about a bus stop type of structure, and we discussed about alternative buildings. So we asked some steel buildings if they would give us a small size building, and they don't provide that small of a building. We looked at the metal buildings, wood sheds from like Home Depot or Lowe's, and we just feel that those type of buildings wouldn't hold up to our severe weather that we have here. So Travis and I were talking about using our blocks, concrete block idea, kind of like you see our enclosures for our trash bins, something like that, and then put a cover on it, put a lid on it. We're talking $1,000, $2,000.
$2,000. Okay. Build it, put a pressure treated shed roof type top on it, paper cut it so the water runs off it, and just attach the crap out of it to the concrete so it doesn't blow off. And then if we ever want to take it off, move it, do anything else with it, access it, it's just moving blocks. And I think it'll suffice plenty for what we're trying to do and protect.
You're just covering it on three sides.
Yeah.
One side only. How big does the structure, would it need to be?
What? I think we're shooting for 12 by 6.
Something like that, yeah.
12 by 6 would be the inside dimension that we're covering. They're 2 feet wide, so the overhanging side, but...
Maybe 12 blocks. 12 blocks of this?
3, 6, 9, 12. 12 to 15 blocks. We might turn one side in and just leave a 6-foot opening, or we'll leave the whole side open and just get 2 gates that can shut and close and lock on it.
My carpenter skills tell me that it ought to be at least rectangular.
It'll be a rectangle.
Yeah. I'm not that good. Okay.
But that's what we find. Unless the board has any other ideas, that's kind of what we're leaning towards doing out there.
That sounds good. I mean, the original thing you came in, it was like 8,000 to 10,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Because I was going to suggest Rubbermaid. I mean, I have 3 Rubbermaid sheds at my house. They last forever. I know you're worried about weather, but anyway, what you're doing sounds good.
Okay, information item 8, 2022 events and support.
Yeah, I figured to give the board a look at what we got so far in line with the events at the port. So we have the artists at the port. And I put in the dates that... that they're looking at doing the event and the location. So, in fact, everything's at pretty much at the boardwalk, except for the 4th of July fireworks. But any questions on that list? Any questions or concerns? What's going to be happening here?
Well, I always have concerns about one of those events, just trying to keep control of it.
So these are pretty much for sure unless something drastic happens. Or
yeah, and yeah, these they all have to have a signed agreement with me already, so it's all good to go.
Now we get into the good news. The RV park project delay. We got a letter from our design firm.
Yeah, I asked them to give us a rundown of what happened. We do have an update. Yesterday, Coosa Curry Electric was out there. They shut down our power to our RV park for a couple hours, they wanted to access the transformers on both sides, see what size conduit it is, and also pull the wire, see if they can pull the wire, and they couldn't pull the wire. It's already in there. So they're assuming it's the conduit is damaged or it's plugged where they can't pull the wire. So
all the trenching, all the concrete?
Well, I don't know if that's, I don't know where it's going to lead to. I talked to Mike Crow today. He's scheduling a meeting with Coos Curry, his electrical guy, and they're going to have a meeting to find out exactly what's going on. Because I don't really want to accept a new conduit. The conduit is big enough to feed their new wire, so is it just one spot that's damaged can be dug up and fixed? I don't know. How hard did they try pulling it? You know, maybe we can help pulling a wire with the travel lift or a reach lift or reach lift, not travel. So I just say let's get some more information from Coos Curry Electric. And I don't, it's their infrastructure. They have easements all over the port. Is it their line? Why is it our fault that the thing's damaged or plugged? That's the other part of my thinking is why are they just throwing it on us? The conduit's the right size for the new power, then why are they making us put a new conduit in? So.
Well, my biggest disappointment with this was the time that that meeting was the week before this was supposed to start. And to find out after a year plus of planning, find out at that moment that, oh, we may not be able to do this, I thought that was just not very appropriate.
Yeah, and I don't know at what time Coos Curry Electric decided to, the reason they want more wires going through is even their load out. So apparently that one wire is enough, but maybe from what we're asking to upgrade everything, it might be a little bit too much of a load, but they want to even it out. So I know Mike Crow is going to be asking that question. It's like, when did they decide to do that? Because when they were planning everything out, everything was fine. So at some point later on, somebody said, let's even out the load, and they failed to tell Mike Crow or us to tell.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the point is that if this project would have required us to trench and bury a new conduit, it's going to be all the way across the kite field underneath the road and into the other RV park. We should have known that at the design stage and not at pre-construction meeting. I mean, that's just not okay.
No,
I agree.
Because as you said when we talked about this the other day, that leaves us two choices. Either we go borrow more money or we cut back on what we intended to do in the RV park to make up the difference. And I don't like either one of those scenarios very much.
When are we going to get the sentence down here? There are probably some other costs associated with the changing out the transformer. Are we talking thousands of dollars? Are we talking hundreds of dollars?
I'm currently getting quotes for the ditch, the conduit, and what it is, but from what I understood in the pre-construction meeting is that with them running three phase over there, that the transformer boxes, the two that are there, would have to get removed and a new one put in. Now, I know when they upgrade things like that with the transformers, you do get some sort of a credit back for the cost of what the current transformers that are there. So that's where I think the more of the cost could incur is that the new transformer is probably going to cost a little bit more. And then you're still paying somebody to install the transformers, the pad, where the transformer is going to sit before Coos Curry can even do it. And like I said, all this was freshly told to us at the pre-construction meeting. So we were as blindsided about it as you guys are. We had no idea.
How long is our bid good on this that we received from McClendon?
I haven't looked at the contract. If the bid number does, I don't know. I would have to look at the contract and see if it does change or if it gave an expiration date on it.
Well,
but I think we definitely got some.
If we're looking at a substantial increase, then I think we would want to rebid it, wouldn't we?
That's possible, but we got to see where this information goes.
We're going to get the cost. I've already asked them to start. Yeah, I know how much this is going to cost, so we know where to move forward. So once we get those costs in, we get some better answers from Coos Curry about and Micro why we landed here, we'll have to reevaluate, basically given the number that we get, you know, how much is it going to cost, and evaluate how we're going to deal with it.
Okay.
I would just like to share my frustration, same as Richard, that we got to this point to find out all this information. We should have known a long time ago.
All right, guys, I got to go pick up my granddaughter.
Okay. More good news. The Lincoln account write-off request.
It's only one, though.
Yeah.
So, just briefly, this gentleman here had two mortgages here with us, and one of his boats was taken on water, and we found out that the boat wasn't seaworthy, and he pretty much left that boat on our hands. He wouldn't take it away from here, so we took it to the dump.
What are the vessels worth, roughly?
He took his other vessel away, the better one. He took that one out, and he refused to do anything with the vessel that was unseaworthy.
Its value was nothing.
I'm sorry?
Nothing.
So basically all we got left was an unpaid bill.
Yeah.
Nothing, no.
Well, we hauled it out. We picked it up. We put it on a trailer and drove it to CTR and dropped it off.
Yeah.
So there's the disposal cost, the transportation cost, and the haul-out cost.
And there are yard days, because there's days that it was in the yard where he wouldn't do anything with it. So we charged him yard days as well.
So our decision at the next meeting then will be one of these three items.
Yeah.
Write off the account and submit it to a collection agency. Write it off, or something else.
Right. And I would be asking the first one, send to collection agency.
All right.
And that brings us to K, Carson Fazio about our wastewater treatment pipeline.
Yeah, so I got a phone call last week from his office, and they were just giving me an update that this is actually before they moved the appropriations bill another 3 weeks further up to March 11th when their new deadline. And they just want to make sure that we knew that the bill, the earmark, is still active, it's still in the bill, and they believe it's going to get passed before March 11th. So that's what DePazio was just want to make sure that we knew that he's still thinking about us and the earmark is still there.
I haven't paid attention to how much this thing in the Ukraine is messing with Congress. I know the president's pretty much detached right now, but I don't know if Congress is all a flutter about it or not. But that should be a good reason to delay it even further.
My guess is it's going to get delayed again. That's my personal opinion, based on what's going on. But
that one's definitely out of our hands. Okay. Comment. I have one.
I'd like to hear it.
Bad news. So today, at 10 o'clock, I attended a teleconference with the Oregon CFMC advisors to talk about the siting of offshore energy projects in Oregon. Today, BOEM, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, released the three collieries that they're going to lease. All three of them are in southern Oregon. There's nothing north of Winchester or Reedsport. One of them sits right directly in front of us. Overlays our tuna fishing spot. It's 440 square miles of ocean. One off of Coos Bay is significantly bigger than that, and it lies right where their tuna fishing occurs. And then the one in Bandon covers what's known as the Bandon High Spot, which is a highly productive area for salmon trolling and halibut fishing. So this came out today. There, the state was taking input on what we wanted to convey to BOEM about all this. So I asked that they ask them to start holding public meetings in Coos Bay and Brookings to get public input on this and let the fishing community start weighing in on this. The only fishing data that they have is based on logbooks from commercial fishermen and VMS, which is the vessel monitoring system that they're required to broadcast. They've got nothing on migration. They don't know where we go, where we fish. So I would like to get that in there. I also asked, not on behalf of the port, but I said it would be a really good idea if BOEM went to the ports that are going to be in this area, like Winchester Bay, Charleston, and us, and tell us what their expectations are for the, what the port's going to, role is going to be in helping maintain this. I mean, are we going to, should we expect a boat to be, you know, a large service vessel? Are they going to buy a lot of diesel fuel? What's in store for us? So we'll see where this goes. But anyway, I, since I heard about this, I just couldn't wait to tell everybody else that. Well, here's maps for you guys.
Are these for sure, or proposed, or what?
These are proposed. These, the contrast between these and the one they did off of Monterey, the one in Monterey was a little tiny block, like 25 square miles. And the reason that they went to this is so that they can maybe move some things around to accommodate some of the uses. You look on that map and you look at where they're proposing to have them. If we cannot enter that to fish or transit, I don't know how that works.
So that's your prime halibut fishing, also.
Well, these, this is the edge of this one is about 20 miles. The Brookings one is about 20 miles offshore, judging by what the scale.
This looks like it, to me. It looks like a 10 feet, not fathoms. If you look at the near shore, in 615, 14.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. Well, knowing the government could be in meters, too. But, but anyway, I just thought I'd bring this up and throw it out there so that you're aware of it. I'll keep you posted as much as I can on this, where we're headed with this thing. But it could have a significant impact on it.
And so, again, these are proposed sites. Are they looking to do all three? Are they looking for the best one? Or?
What they're proposing to do is to use these as what are known as call areas in Lisa.
All three?
Yeah. The problem, as I understand it here, is that there's only one point, which is near Denmark. So just south of Langhorne, there's only one point where there is a tie-in to the Oregon Grid that goes across the valley on, in this area.
So they're going to go this way and then in?
So the other, they would bring that power on land and then run it up? Or
somewhere in here, there's going to be a series of underwater cables that are going to connect these to the power grid. Those cables have a huge impact for the bottom trawl fleet because they can't trawl over.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that, there's just a ton of things about this that are problematic. Plus, this goes in the power grid, and it can be sold to the highest bidder, which will be California. So the direct benefits to Oregon, to me, are sketchy. I asked about constructing these things. I'm thinking Coos Bay, and they said no. Most likely, they would actually build these platforms in either San Francisco or Seattle and tow them because they're big.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the other thing that we pointed out is everything right now that's currently in place is on the East Coast, which is on the protected side of the continent. You've got the continent, and then you got the ocean, so it blocked everything. In our case, we're not. We're facing 5,000 miles of ocean. And there's a reason there are no offshore piers north of, you know, central California. It's because they don't last. They can't withstand the wave and storm action we get. So there's a lot of question in everybody's mind whether this is even going to work. But here's where we are.
Is there any way to stop it?
Two things that could affect it would be the midterm election and the presidential election. So the current administration is pushing this. That's why this is on a fast track. That could change with a change in Congress who decided they didn't want to push it, or an administration that came in and said, no, we don't want it. So.
Well, a few months ago back, I don't know, was it Maine or wherever, the commercial fishermen were suing the government or trying, because they were saying it was affecting their...
Maine has some lobster issues.
Right.
Apparently there's been some work done on these things with crustaceans, and they do affect the movement of crab, which again is another issue for us here. So there's a lot to find out about this, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. And most likely we're going to learn the hard way. Anyway, anything else? Our next regular meeting will be Wednesday, March 16th, 2020 at 2 p.m. With that, we are adjourned.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Richard.
That's for the
icing on the cake, huh?